This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I am talking to Alex Gilvary. He's the author of From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant. It's a novel, and I think it's a really, really good and interesting novel that I think you will find interesting. So, Alex, how are you? And did I pronounce your name at all correctly?
Yes, you did. Thanks for having me, David.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So how long has this been? We're talking in January 2012. The book's fairly new, yes?
Right, yeah. It just came out on January 9th. So I've been a published author for about 5 days now.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, you were previously, you've been an editor?
Yeah, I was an editor at Picador for about a year before up until about the summer, and I was an assistant editor there, and they published many great paperbacks, and then I was also a production editor before that. I worked for many years at Scholastic during the Harry Potter years.
Oh yeah,
they were very exciting.
So how did you fit in writing a novel with having a full-time job in publishing?
Yeah, you know, that's the big trick. It's really, really hard to do. I started the novel in 2006, probably when I was working at Scholastic at the time, and I would write at nights, or sometimes I would get up at 6 in the morning and then just try and do an hour before work and squeeze it in whenever I could. And after about several months of this, I realized I only had about 15, 20 pages of the novel, and I said, this is going to take a really long time. So, I started applying for graduate programs in creative writing, the MFA in creative writing, and I submitted to those with my a portion of the book that I had written. I think I only had about 20, 25 pages at the time, and for me, it was justification to get into one that I could leave my job and work on a novel for 2 years.
And so you did.
And so I did, yeah. And so I did, and it took me about 3 years to write. You know, I went to Hunter College, and I studied with Colin McCann and Peter Carey, and I had some great mentors there, and after the 3 years, the novel was completed, and then I became an editor at Picador while I was trying to sell it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book. I think it's it's very difficult, I think, to write a novel which has a political message or even a political viewpoint. So
right.
I think I'm guessing you know that, obviously, and that what you chose to do was write satirically in order to free yourself from the, the notion of any polemicism that might get into the book. And I think, let's just talk a little bit about, the main character in the novel who has your name for him is fantastic. I don't know whether he's a Filipino who comes to America. He had grown up in the Philippines, fascinated with fashion, breaking the the stereotypical view of a fashionista boy, man. He's not gay. He's kind of, in fact, actively heterosexual. And but his name is it Boyette?
It's Boyette Hernandez. Yeah. He goes by Boy, for short in the novel.
Which is a great name for any character, to be named Boy. And then it becomes his fashion line. And obviously we're not going to tell too much of the story in terms of giving it away, but where you place him is he arrives in America. It's the period after 9/11, so there's a certain fraught atmosphere, and where you've placed him, I don't think we're giving away too much. He's in he's at Guantanamo in one of the cells where terrorists have been put. That's how the book is, basically structured as a flashback from Guantanamo.
Yeah.
And it's really, I think you've captured the, you know, I want to, you know, not ask the question here, but just give you some praise because I think you've captured the ethos of America. Yeah, I don't think it's different today than it was 4 or 5 years ago. This sense of, you know, fear-driven behavior by the polity and by the government structure that puts him in this position of being in Guantanamo, where we learn throughout the book how he got there. It's pretty powerful.
Thank you so much. That is such a that's such an excellent read of my book, and it makes me feel so happy because, you know, these were the things that I was trying, you know, trying and hoping to do, and editing to make it, you know, to get that in there and to get it right, and, you know, so it didn't sound polemic, as you said. And no, I'm flattered that you've read it that way. I really appreciate it.
Well, it means you succeeded. So, but I think that I like the characters too. You know, you've got Boy himself, who is a pretty interesting character. You know, you've got him very. You know, he's telling his story. It's personal, but the characters around him who are related to him, fashion people who he's associated with, this guy who ends up being connected in some way to Al-Qaeda, Qureshi, that guy.
Ahmed Qureshi. He's a garment salesman that Boy, you know, meets when he comes to New York to try and launch his fashion label. And this man, Qureshi, becomes Boy's benefactor in a way.
Right, he helps him. He actually finances a startup of his of his label, you know, his and but you must know something about fashion from the inside. These characters sound really authentic to me. Now, I don't know fashion that well, but you know, they don't seem to be you know, they do seem to be representative. So do you, I mean, you spent some time in the fashion business, it
Thank you.
seems.
Yeah, you know, as I said, I'd worked for the children's publisher Scholastic, and they're very strangely, their offices are located in Soho, New York. You know, the very most fashionable part of Manhattan. And so, you know, on my lunch break every day, I would see very high fashionable people, models going to and from their castings, you know, carrying their portfolios. And I would see fashion designers around, and there are all these high-priced boutiques. And this was the kind of neighborhood I worked in, you know, and I was just a copy editor. You know, I worked on books about ponies and unicorns. And so I was just surrounded by it. And then also at the time, my girlfriend, Ashley Mears, she's also a writer. She wrote a book called Pricing Beauty about the modeling industry. She worked in fashion prior to me writing this book. And so you know, I ended up at a lot of fashion parties and you know, runway shows, just with no real purpose there, just an observer, just there to, you know, to support her. And then later on, it became material for the novel when I fell upon the character of Boy, a Filipino immigrant, and a fashion designer.
Well, it's great to connect fashion and terrorism. I think that's sort of right there, you've got this kind of disjunctive thing going on that you know, kind of startles you in a certain way, you know, that you can see that there's some humor at work, because you've taken what might be the most unlikely person on earth to be a terrorist, and there he is, you know, and he throughout the novel he what is he's known as the fashion terrorista.
The New York Post dubs him the fashion terrorist, and you know, it gets completely blown out of proportion.
Right, and so you know these, but the characters. I mean, where do you come? You know, how did you? Are they from your imagination completely, or do you have people that you were thinking of, not necessarily modeling on, but you know, especially you know, a couple of these, you know, sort of more shady characters.
You know, I did. I mean, a lot of the characters just grew out of my imagination. They grew out of the story, you know, sort of organically. You know, the character of boy's publicist is a character named Ben Laden, you know, and
Well, yeah.
he's just somebody, BEN
Right.
Laden, and he's
And
Irish. He's
right.
not there's no relation. And you know, that's a character who grew out of the story organically. And so most of the fashion people are sort of made up or things or you know, I use sound bites that I had overheard over the years. But you know, the terrorist side of the story, the darker side of the story, you know, the character of Ahmed Qureshi, this garment salesman. In this sense, I was pulling from a lot of terrorism cases that had happened over the last decade since 9/11. They were, of course, really interesting to me. They were really disturbing, and they were different ways of, you know, there were different ways of prosecuting these men. A lot of these men were have been, you know, locked up before they committed a crime. You know, before they got involved in actual terrorism. And so, with the character of Ahmed Qureshi, I was pulling a little bit from the story of Hemant Lakhani, who was a real guy. I think he was some kind of salesman who sold some missiles to an FBI informant in New Jersey, I believe. And they, you know, I think the guy is now doing some serious time, maybe even life. But he was prosecuted, so that's one of the cases that I would pull from. And then in the parts that take place in Guantanamo, this is Boy's memoir from prison. This is his confession, as you said. This is how he tells the story. And so the narrative present of the novel, there are many detainees and prisoners with him that he meets. There are guards. And all of these characters, I've either, you know, imagined, well, I primarily imagined them, but, you know, I was always heavily researching real people there. Some real detainees are mentioned in the novel, like the Australian David Hicks. He, you know, he's at Guantanamo the same time Boy is there. So, yeah.
And so what made you pick the Philippines for Boy? I mean, how does that work? Was it you're thinking of you had to have an immigrant story?
Well,
but what is it?
Yeah, the Philippines is where my mother is from. She immigrated here in the late 60s, and so I'm half Filipino. I've been to the Philippines many times. It's a country that's, and you know, it's an identity, my own that, I've always been very interested in and that I've always wanted to write about. Filipino American literature isn't huge in this country. and America has had a big hand in Filipino culture, I would say. And this is something I want to write about, through a man who comes from Manila and who is in love and in some ways obsessed with America and being American.
No, that makes sense. So, but since you grew up in America, I assume you don't speak Tagalog or.
No, I don't speak Tagalog, and it's strange when I go there. When I go to the Philippines, I don't need to. Everybody speaks English. It's very strange, but
right.
You know, primarily in Manila and Cebu,
right?
The major cities, yeah. And so, and as I say in the book, they speak an American sort of English too.
Right, because they get it from television,
right? Yeah,
to a certain extent, or maybe from the Navy, the sailors being.
Yeah,
there.
The Navy. Yeah, we've been there a long time since
maybe
before World War II. Yeah.
No, in fact, well, it goes back to 1897, I think.
With yes.
Spanish-American War.
You're right.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. So, it's still a foreign country. He's coming to America with you know, an immigrant's sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
But he has, and you know, obviously a connection to America through, you know, the Philippine American connection. But but you're able to then, you know, he sees him. You get to give this view of a New York, you know, from an outsider's point of view, someone who's kind of wildly in love with New York.
You know, and that's myself too. I grew up in New York. I was born here. But it's a very, you know, amazing, beautiful city to love and to look at like you're here for the first time. I mean, when I go, even though I've spent my whole life here, when I go to Times Square, I suddenly feel like, you know, a tourist that I've been here for the first, you know, time, you know, and it's a city that's always in flux. So it actually wasn't very hard for me to write about New York City, from the perspective of, somebody just arriving here.
Yeah, no, that came across, and I think New York has a special place in literature. You know, it does inspire people in so many ways. I recently read, and I then interviewed a guy who wrote a book called Rules of Civility, Amor Towles, which, by the way, is a great book.
Yeah, and I've heard of it. It's on my list.
It takes place in 1938, and it has obviously a different approach than you took, but there is a sort of, I can almost see a connection there that is driven by the city itself, that the city has so many, and it, you know, you got to be careful because the romantic sentimentality of New York has been done a number of times in novels, but still, you know, it's so powerful as a driver of culture, and it offers so many new stories.
It does. You're right. I mean, there's so many pockets of this city that I don't know and that haven't been explored in literature yet. And the New York, you know, everybody's coming here for the first time every day and moving here, and there are endless amounts of stories, you know, for novels.
Oh, yeah. I can. I mean, you sort of imagine looking just, I mean, as you were saying, you know, when you go to Times Square or any place in New York where there's so many people. Everybody, I sometimes find myself doing that, or on the subway, I'm looking at people idly, trying not to make eye contact or let them see that I'm looking at them, but trying to imagine their stories.
Yeah.
You know, from looking at them, which is, of course, ridiculous, because you don't know what anybody's story is just from looking at them.
No, but, you know, that's how the writer thinks, I think, and that's why New York is such a great place to discover stories, because I do the same thing. I ride the subway, and I see somebody, I think of a story. In the novel, Boy is in the beginning of the novel, he sees a man very much like him wearing a sandwich board. You know?
Right, right. Oh,
that was almost identical to him. And,
yeah.
You know, there's this, and he feels sorry for the guy who looks just like him and probably came here hoping for something better. And he's handing out flyers, and he's like this walking sandwich board. And you know, that's a job. That's something I saw. I was walking around yesterday. I saw three people doing that.
Right.
You know, and I just kind of imagined people's lives, and you know, that's where characters come from, I think.
No, that's true. That was actually a great image, because we all face that. If we're being honest with ourselves, when you walk around New York or any place, you see people who are just like you, except that their circumstances are very different.
Yeah.
And in his case, what he was looking at was, this is what I don't want to be.
Right.
You know, I am committing my life to being something more interesting and somebody better. Of course, then there's that irony that he ends up in Guantanamo.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a, you don't know this at the beginning when he's looking at his doppelganger, essentially, but there is a certain, later, I think you can feel a certain amount of discomfort, let's say, at his position. Now, of course, let's talk about I think you've imagined pretty amazingly the feeling that somebody gets being in this place. You know, you talk about that. I thought that was very striking and early on, and is that, you know, he goes from having a kind of forward velocity to being stopped. He has nothing then. He's almost in a bubble, but it's kind of out of time, out of place. There's a surreal quality to the life that you describe, which I, you know, obviously neither you nor I can know what that really is like. So it has to come from your imagination. I thought you captured it really well.
Thank you.
You know, the idea that you no longer are the person that you were. It's been taken away from you, and in his case, he couldn't figure out why.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not in the book. It's not readily being told to him why he's there, why he's imprisoned.
Right, which is part of the horror of this whole denial of rights, which is, now we get into the political element of it, and that is, and which, you know, recently was highlighted because President Obama signed a document saying that he could suspend habeas corpus and due process at will. which they've already been doing in this context because they're able to say you're a military combatant, you're outside of the normal, you're in Guantanamo, you're not in America, you're not part of the American prison justice system. Everything becomes turned upside down. You know, you can't be defended because your defense can't get information. It's amazing. Yeah.
You're being you know, at times in these military tribunals, you know, prosecuted on classified information that you're not allowed to hear. I mean, the situation almost it's so absurd, it almost sounds like fiction.
Right.
And so when I was writing, I didn't have to make anything up. I mean, I was just pulling from things that have happened over the last 10 years that Guantanamo and these tribunals have been going on. Well, they've been going on, you know, less than that. But no, you're right. You're right. And the president has recently signed that Defense Act, which, you know, one of the leaps I had to take with this novel was to take a man who's captured on U.S. soil and send him to Guantanamo Bay. When I began the novel, that actually that couldn't happen in this country. We have assurances that if you're arrested here, you know, you'll be prosecuted. There's due process. You'll be read your rights. But now with this new Defense Act that has been pushed through, and I believe now the bill has become a law, although the president signed it with some, you know, hesitancy. It does say an American citizen can be captured by the military and tried in a tribunal, although the president has said and made some assurances that would not happen and he would not allow it. Although I don't know how the safety net would work. So many people have slipped through the cracks over the last couple of years. I mean, right. It's a very scary thought.
Right. It's hard to believe someone's assurances that a drastically radical act like suspending habeas corpus will never be, you know, it will never be enforced. Well, that makes no sense. Then if it was never going to be enforced, then why would you sign it? And if who knows what another president would do? This is the problem is, now the law is in effect and there is a certain amount of, let's say, discomfort at the notion that we could have somebody different. Obama could really mean what he says. He would never use it. Never in a million years. It won't happen. But he's not president forever. Once that law is in place, the next president could use it. It's why it is sort of shocking that after over 230 years of government, we have this happen at a time when there are lots of people proclaiming that we're losing our rights. And, you know, I don't see any big uproar in the politics. It's more about all I see is who's going to be the next nominee for the Republicans to run against Obama. That's the only thing that's in the news.
Right. Yeah. It's become, and this is it's an election year. So nothing, nobody's doing anything major to change things or shake things up. This is certainly major, and this is incredibly frightening. This prison, we were given an assurance that it would have been closed down in a year, and it's still open, and it's still in existence.
That's exactly right. Well, it actually is good for you in your novel, because if Guantanamo wasn't still there, it would be less powerful.
I wrote it with always the intention that I knew the prison would be closed by the time it came out. You know, it's 2012 already. I started in 2007. And it's just incredible that it's still going on. I think at last count, there's 171 prisoners still there trying to be moved. Nobody wants them on U.S. soil. According to the New York Times, keeping a prisoner there annually costs about $800,000, whereas here I think it costs something like $40,000, to house a prisoner. So even financially, it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make sense. Well, so have you had any responses to the book? I know it's early, but have you heard people being critical of you for writing a book that is satirical and kind of negative about the American government. Or, I mean, I'm not saying that you would. I'm just
No,
curious if that's
I did.
happened.
Yeah, no, I've gotten some feedback already. You know, the book just came out on Monday past, and I've gotten nothing but positive feedback, actually. Nobody has been you know, in an uproar or too critical about it. But I mean, I did get my first letter by a man who had actually worked with Guantanamo detainees, and he was very, even though it's a satire and sometimes a farce, he was very moved by it, and he said, "This book is doing something that we've been trying to do for years, which is to get people to read about Guantanamo."
Well, it's probably true. It's a lot. I think it's better to read a novel than it is to, for a lot of people, they don't want to read kind of political nonfiction. They're kind of in denial on some level. It's
Right,
the problems seem so big. There's no way to overcome them. Maybe a novel is in fact a more effective way of because you're able to attract people through story, and that's kind of the indirect, it's when I studied fiction, that was what it was all about, is how writers, in a sense, fiction is all about indirection.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You know, although there are many, many great books out there about Guantanamo by detainees, actual memoirs, people haven't really been reading them, or you know, they're very heavy subjects, and I understand that too. And I think you know, for me, then I have to believe that the novel still has the ability to affect the way people think. I know it certainly has for me, and so that's what I was hoping with this book.
Well, I hope that happens, because, in the sense that all, all politics is part of our imagination in some way. You've got to capture people's imagination to get them involved, and maybe that'll happen. I mean, the characters are, as I said before, I think your characters are great, and I really love the character of Boy. I think it's a, he's an amazing creation, and I think that if people can get involved with him and his story and see how the sort of the absurdity of what happened to him is kind of is real, it's you're not, again, you're not in any way heavy-handed in that, but I think it's really inevitable. If you read the novel, you will think about the political circumstance.
Well, thank you so much, because you know that is really what I had hoped to get at with by the end of this book. And that's just it's I'm really flattered.
Well, thanks for saying that. But again, I think it's a sign of your success in writing the novel. So
Thank you.
anyway, so it's been great talking to you. I think that I hope that as this book is launched, more and more people will find it. And I want to wish you luck in the period I guess you're in now, which is the promotional period and the going out there
Yeah,
and talking to
yes.
people. But it's a terrific book, and I'm certainly going to recommend it to people.
Thank
So,
you, David.
all
Thanks
right.
for having me.
It's a pleasure, Alex. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Alex Gilvary about From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant.